Why does the Quran state Allah, the best deceiver, in Surah 354? And how does that relate to its denial of Christ's death on the cross? Does the Quran give an accurate picture of the doctrine of the Trinity that Christians believe? And is the Trinity important in the redemption of humanity? Also, why do so many religions boast of meritorious works for salvation? Join us today as we tackle these and other questions as we take this time to stop and think about it.
Hello? Hello, anybody home? Think, McFly, think.
I'm thinking.
What were you thinking?
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Don't say anything now. Just think about it.
You're listening to Stop and Think About It, a podcast for the Christian thinker. In a day when sound biblical preaching has been replaced by man-centered entertainment and the church has become increasingly anti-intellectual, this podcast will encourage believers to think biblically and theologically. So please join me as we get ready to stop and think about it.
So here we are continuing, and there are several questions raised by Ishmael, who is the producer of this podcast. And so no doubt some of you may have the same questions or may not even realize some of these things concerning Islam, Judaism, Christianity. And so if you knew about such things, you would have questions raised in your mind as well. So one of the questions is concerning Surah 354, which speaks of Allah being the best or greatest deceiver. So, Andrew, can you speak to us? I mean, what would a Muslim say to their God being a deceiver?
Well, we get this, as you mentioned, Surah 354, which says, and they schemed, and Allah schemed, and Allah is the best of schemers. Now, the word schemer here in the more modern translations are going to say, it's going to say planner. But the word, as far as I understand, and everyone that I have seen and asked in the lexicons and whatnot, all say that this is referring to deceiver. Okay, so literally it would be to cheat or deceive. So literally it would be they cheated or deceived, and God cheated or deceived, but God is the best of cheaters and deceivers. And with any, you could do this in English with any Greek word as well. It's called context. The context is going to define the meaning of the word. So the question is, what were they deceiving about? And it's always good to read a little bit of the context. Let me start with Surah 350 and we'll just read. It says, and confirming that which was before me of the Torah, and to make lawful some of that which was forbidden to you, I come to you with a sign from your Lord. So keep your duty to Allah and obey me. Lo, Allah is my Lord and your Lord, so worship him. That is a straight path. But when Jesus became conscious of their disbelief, he cried, who will be my helpers in the cause of Allah? And the disciples said, we will be Allah's helpers. We believe in Allah and bear witness that we have surrendered unto him. O Lord, we believe in that which has revealed and followed whom thou hast sent. Enroll us among those who witness. And they schemed, and Allah schemed, and Allah is the best of schemers. Then verse 55, and when Jesus said, and when Allah said, O Jesus, lo, I am gathering thee, causing thee to ascend unto me, and am cleansing thee of those who disbelieve, and am setting those who follow thee above those who disbelieve until the day of resurrection. Then unto me ye shall return, and I shall judge you as within ye used to defer. So what this ends up dealing with is the thing that we mentioned earlier about this day of the resurrection. And it goes on further to explain this, but this is the deception. So he's the great deceiver in the case that he could take the likeness. And this is what it says a few verses later in 58 and 59. Well, I'll just read those. It says, "This we recite unto thee in Revelation and a wise reminder, lo, the likeness of Jesus with Allah is in the likeness of Adam. He was created of the dust and he was made unto him." So the idea is that Allah took Jesus and made the likeness of him. And this is what is believed at the cross happened. That Allah, if you want to say he planned it, okay, he planned it. But the fact is, if Allah took his followers, because that's who thought that this was Jesus on the cross, not just the unbelievers, but there were many followers that believed this. So if he took followers and makes a likeness of Jesus, what would we call that? I mean, it's not a matter of saying, well, you know, if you want to argue over the word, and that's what people do, whether the word planner, that they'll often translate it as, which means a schemer, a cheater, a deceiver, does it actually mean, you know, schemer, deceiver? Now, words have meanings. But when you put this in the idea of speaking of the actions of what Allah does at the day of resurrection, you know, with Christ's death on the cross, well, what do you have? You have a case where Allah deceived his own people. So it's easy to see this as a deceiver, as him being the greatest of deceivers. Now, in the context, can we say that this is one where this direct context, he's talking about planning? Is that a viable option? Yes.
Planning, yeah.
We could say that God is the best, but men plan, God plans, God's the best planner. No problem. Right. We could say that, and that would be fitting. So in this context, is it talking about specifically what he does with Jesus on the cross? No, that's not this context. But where many people see the issue is what he does with Jesus on the cross is a deception.
Right.
And that's the reason so many people look to this passage where when you translate it literally, it looks like it's saying that Allah is the best deceiver or cheater.
Yeah. Well, one of my main issues with this is that the people that walked with Jesus in the first century wrote of him and they were eyewitnesses, just as it says in 1 John. Well, what we had heard, what we had seen, what we had touched with our hands, and that dealing with mostly with Gnosticism, who believed Jesus was some kind of phantom or ghost or an apparition of some kind. But why would I believe a book that comes like 600 years later with people that never walked with Jesus, never spoke with him, were not eyewitnesses? I mean, looking, they're going to look back and like rewrite history. I mean, I'm going with the eyewitnesses, and it wasn't just one. It was, like you said before, there were 500 eyewitnesses who did not, you know, have like a mass hallucination. So how can you just go rewrite that? I mean, what if we came along and said, well, Muhammad, he just never existed. Can we just go and rewrite history now?
Well, you could try. It just doesn't, it's not accurate history, but yes, you can. I mean, we have that in school today.
Well, yes. It's called revisionism.
Yeah.
Well, so this is a great example of revisionism then.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's, but the issue is, so would I bring up, and this is the real issue, would I bring up Surah 354?
Yes.
Speaking to a Muslim about this? I do not. And the reason I do not is because this is why I wanted to read some of the context before and after. and show you that this is not dealing specifically with a deception. Okay. Now, could this refer to men scheming, but God, and God schemes, and God's a better schemer? There's nothing that says in from the context, no. But I go to the actions of Allah himself. It doesn't matter whether this passage, in a literal translation, yes, it would say that Allah is the greatest schemer or deceiver. But you're going to get into a debate with a Muslim over, well, no, that means planner, and God's the best planner. Okay, but here's the thing. What happened at the cross? And that's where you really want to go to, because that's a harder thing to have to answer, because to answer that, they have to admit that God created someone in the likeness of Jesus to be on that cross.
Right.
That is deception. I mean, so we can argue over words and meanings of words in the context, but what we can't argue is the actions. So the action is really clear that he deceived his own followers by having a lookalike on the cross.
And if Jesus was a truth teller, and of course he was, he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. He said he was going to die. Mm-hmm. I mean, he went around, he said, I'm going to die. And so how would he say that? And then there was the deception. So then we got a sort of a double deception, because that means Jesus lied or deceived, and then Allah deceived. Well, this creates more problems than answers, does it not?
Yeah. But all right, so here's the thing with Islam that for many Christians to understand.
Yes.
So Islam means to submit.
Right.
A Muslim is one who submits. So understand that going into it, because as we discuss this, you're going to get frustrated sometimes speaking to a Muslim, because they will throw logic out the window, common sense out the window, because they must submit to the Quran. And if the Quran is in error, they still must submit. We have a similar thing, right? We submit to the Bible, but there aren't contradictions in the Bible. And that right. makes it very different. Like we said, when the Quran teaches that the Trinity is the Father, the Mother, and the Son, that's not what the Bible teaches. That's not what any Christian believes. So you have in Surah 5, 116, it says, O Jesus, the Son of Mary, yeah. dost thou say unto men, worship me and my mother as gods? Well, we do not believe Mary is God. Even the Catholic Church that treats her like God, gives her attributes of deity, deny that she's God.
Right.
But Muhammad was not in touch with other Christians that would know this. So the way James White would say it is the writer of the Quran did not know the Trinity. He would refer to the writer of the Quran. Well, who wrote the Quran? Well, we don't know if it's really Muhammad, just so you realize, because Muhammad recited these things, people memorized them. I think the real writer of the Quran would be whoever wrote the one that wrote down what Uthman accepted. And my guess, it was probably Uthman. If Uthman wrote it down, my guess is he looked at the others and went, Pern knows what I said was right.
Sure. Yes.
I have no record of that, but that's the thing is you look at this, that is a category error, a definitional error. And you look at when you have the logic I gave earlier, if God wrote through Moses and it was corrupted and David and it was corrupted and Jesus is corrupted and Muhammad, and we know, we don't know what the others that they claim, we don't see the textual variances like we are discussing with those other writers, but with Muhammad, the collection of it, Uthman is the source. The one who collected these is the source of where I'm going to say that there were variances. Why? because if there was no variances, there would be no abhorrent text to burn.
There you go. You made it almost logical.
But see, they will throw all that out, though. You see, that's the point.
No pun intended. I saw what you did right there.
They will sit there, and you can work through this with them, and they will just blindly follow the Quran. We do not blindly follow the Bible. We do textual criticism. We examine things. We put the Bible under microscopes as Christians. But if you do that with the Quran, you realize it's invalid. And that's the thing. And that, so they, you just have to understand, they will throw logic out the window.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, they have their creation story is that we were created from a blood clot, water, a sperm cell, and clay.
Well, they also say in the Quran that the sperm is produced in the small of the back. So, and I've actually heard a guy that called up Matt Slick's program and tried to argue to Matt that Matt doesn't understand biology and that the sperm actually does form in the small of the back and work its way down the testicles. I was like, yeah, no. And then another guy tried to argue that the whole lower region of the man is referred to as small of the back.
Oh, well, maybe it started forming when the man was on his back. I don't know, but yeah. That's another story. So what about this aspect of Christ being the fulfillment of the law? I mean, Muhammad can't fit that bill.
Not the way Christians would understand that, no. And
right.
So you have to understand, if Christ was the fulfillment of the law, then there are no prophets that will come after him.
Right.
And yet, Muhammad is another prophet. And it is a weird thing, if you think about it. In Islam, they accept that Jesus Christ was virgin born and did these miracles and had a miraculous birth and a miraculous death. Miraculous death being that he wasn't crucified. He was just a lookalike was on there. So he has all this miraculous stuff in his life, and then you have an ordinary life for Muhammad.
Right.
The greatest prophet ever has the least miracles in his life ever. It does seem odd, not saying it's impossible, but it would say that Christ could not be the fulfillment of the law if there was another prophet, which goes, by the way, to the extent of those that claim to be prophets today. Because if you're a prophet, then you're still expounding on the law. And I would say that then Christ couldn't be the fulfillment of the law.
Right, right. Because, I mean, there were certainly qualifications to being a prophet. Deuteronomy 18, does Muhammad fulfill the requirements, qualifications of being a prophet of God?
No.
No.
I mean,
But he thought he was in line with Moses and Jonah and Jesus, but I mean, he can't even tie their sandals. And I don't say that necessarily disrespectfully, but what they spoke about and what they did is in alignment to each other. And Muhammad came out of left field and brought things in that were out of alignment with the same that he believed he was in alignment with. So, you know, it's like if there were three guys on the Yankees and another guy came along and he's on the Mets and he says, I'm on the team. He just doesn't fit in, even though he's a baseball player, so to speak. That doesn't mean he's automatically a Yankee player, even though he might know how to throw and catch. And so Muhammad might know how to do certain things, but he's not in line with these other men.
So he thought he was a prophet. He thought he was a follower of Judaism and Christianity. And what some don't know is Jewish people always pray facing Jerusalem. And he did the same.
Yes, he did.
Until he was rejected by the Jewish people as a prophet. And when he was rejected as a prophet, he then turned to face Mecca.
Right.
And that's where Muslims today will face and pray. And so that right there you got to realize that in his mind, he really saw himself as the continuation of Christ. But then when rejected, he starts rejecting the teachings of Judaism and Christianity. And so if you read the Quran chronologically, it reads very different. People don't realize that the Quran is listed, the books are in size order, except for the first one. And so if you read it chronologically, though, it gives a different reading because you can see where there was a lot of talk of peace in the beginning and later warfare, accepting the people of the book and the book, referring to the Jewish and Christians who follow the Bible and the Bible.
Yes.
To later that they're corrupted the book, things like this. So you can see historically, and I think if people read the Quran chronologically, they get a different understanding of it. Mm. I will say it's a confusing book.
Sure.
They say in Arabic, it is the most beautiful thing ever. I think that's a bias. I mean, it sounds really nice when they sing it. And okay, but that's not what it's where, you know, when you're saying it's the most beautiful book ever, you're talking about the words.
And right.
It is a confusing book. It's not an easy read.
Yeah, no, it's not at all. So concerning the Trinity, back to that, why is the Trinity important to our redemption versus the denial of it by not only Islam, but Judaism and all the other world religions per se?
The Trinity is important for this reason. It's important to have the right God. Do you need to believe in the Trinity to be saved? I would say no. Coming from Judaism, I knew nothing about the Trinity. I repented and believed in Jesus, but I did not know anything about the Trinity. Now, when I heard the Christian doctrine of the Trinity and I started studying, I had no problem with it. It is a solution to a problem. The problem is you have three individual people, Jesus, the Father, and the Spirit, that are all called God, do the works of God, have the attributes of God, and yet they're separate and distinct from one another. So the Trinity is a way of giving a definition to answer how you can have three persons in one Godhead, but they're still separate and distinct. So denying that, though, like if you understand the Bible, Matt Slick and I recently did a debate with guys that are monarchists. And so they believe there's one person, one God. And so when you know the definition of the Trinity, you understand the biblical teaching of the Trinity and deny it. That's different because now you have a different God. You can't be saved. It's like, I always refer to this, but there's a movie the Kendrick brothers put together. Now I forget the name of the title. I think it's Courageous. But there's a scene in there that I always resonate with where, you know, they have this guy, I forget the character's name. I'll just say Hector, but I don't think that was it. But he was saying, hey, you know, Hector, the guy goes to meet his buddy and his buddy says, you know, hey, I'm sorry that Hector never made it to your house to work on your house. And he goes, well, what do you mean? Hector's at my house right now.
Oh, Javier.
Javier. Okay, that's Javier. There we go. So Javier, he goes, what do you mean? Javier's at my house right now. He says, he can't be. Javier's in the hospital. Right. What do you mean? So he describes, was Javier, you know, he's a, you know, 6'2" thin guy. No, he's, you know, 5'10" and, you know, kind of pudgy working at my house, you know. And what was the issue? The realization that they were talking two different Javiers.
Right.
And so all of a sudden it becomes a problem. If you have a Jesus by a different name is not the Jesus of the Bible. So having a Jesus that's not part of the Trinity is not the Jesus that can save you.
Right.
Because it's a wrong Jesus. And that's why the Trinity does matter. Now, I'm not saying, and I'm trying to be clear with it, you don't have to believe in the Trinity to be saved, but you can't deny the Trinity and be saved. So there's a difference in the way I worded that, right? There's one is, the first is one of ignorance. The one is without the ignorance and rejection.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Augustine or someone else who said, if you try to understand the Trinity, you'll lose your mind. And if you reject the Trinity, you lose your soul. And so there's a difference in, like you said, trying to comprehend it. Because, I mean, listen, if I said, you know what a zebra is? And you say, no. And I said, well, it's kind of like a horse. It's got, you know, black and white stripes on it. There's a focal point that I could point to one animal and then point to another and say, well, this is like that. I can't look to anything in the entire universe to image and say, well, this is God, and try to image the Trinity with all the ways that people have tried with an egg, with water, ice, and steam, or all the other things. That just substantiates the heresy of modalism or Sabellianism, which many hold to, such as a T.D. Jakes and others. So they deny the Trinity.
Especially because zebras and horses are different species.
Right, they are. So
that's a good example.
I went to the Creation Museum and they had a Zorse there. They mated two together and they got a Zorse and a Zonkey. Now, as far as Passover is concerned, Jews today, they're commemorating or celebrating Passover. Where are they getting it wrong compared to what happened in the Exodus?
So what happened in the Exodus wouldn't have been anything like the Passover that was celebrated today or even in the early centuries after Passover. Keep in mind, the Passover that's celebrated, and for any of our theonomist friends out there who believe that we should be keeping the law, Passover is a command to keep forever. Just saying, if you're going to be a theonomist, I hope you're keeping Passover. But the reality is that Passover is a memorial, very much like we do a baptism as a memorial, what Christ did with us. We do a Lord's Supper. That's a memorial of, you know, what Christ did on the cross. This is a memorial to remind us. And so a lot of it, as far as we know, goes back early first century, even pre-Christ. But keep in mind, going all the way back to how did they do it specifically in the time of, you know, their time in the wilderness or in Israel, as we read in the Old Testament, we don't have a lot to go off of. There's just not a lot of literature there. So we can't be specific enough to say, well, this is how they did it. The first Passover celebration after the Exodus, this is how we can't do that,
right?
Because it just isn't there. But there's a lot of interesting things with the Passover, and there have been things over time that have changed with the Passover Seder. For example, ever since 70 AD, at least that's when it's credited, at the end of the Seder, we would raise a glass of wine and say next year in Jerusalem. Because once the Jews were out of Jerusalem and could no longer have the Passover in Jerusalem, they would do that. Funny story with the Passover. At the end of Passover, you're supposed to open the door. The youngest male is supposed to go to the door and open the door. You have a seat set aside for Elijah, because Elijah is going to be the one that ushers in the Messiah. And you're supposed to open the door to look for Elijah. So I got sent to look for Elijah. And at that moment, there was my uncle standing at the door because his flight got in late and he just got there. Just as I opened the door, he was about to hit the doorbell. So I turned to my family and said, Elijah's here, and it's Uncle Alan. I didn't know he was Elijah. But there have been changes that have occurred in the Seder. Now, there are some things that Christians find very interesting with the Seder. There's a part of the Seder where we would take three matzots, the unleavened bread, and you have three of them. You take one, you split it, you break it, you put that in the middle, and then you hide that one, the other half of it, and the kids have to go find it
and bring it back out.
Yeah. Now it is kind of interesting. Now, is that something that we would see in the original Passover? I doubt it very much, because the word for that is afikomen, which is a Greek word. And so that had to have been something that was added in over time with the influence of Greek, or at least the name of that. But where Christians find a lot of symbolism is that they see three from the Trinity. The middle one is broken.
Second member.
The second member broken, hidden away for a later time for the end of the celebration.
Resurrection.
That's exactly right. And that's how a lot of Christians like look at that part of the Seder. Now, the interesting thing is I did some study into looking at the rabbi's explanation of where that started and the meaning of it. And there is not a clear understanding of where that began or why they do it. I find it very interesting. Now, is that proof that that's foretelling of the Messiah, that he would come and he'd be broken on earth and then come back later in his second coming? By the way, the Christians who would hold to that obviously hold to a premillennial view, because to hold to that, it's that Christ would come back and be the king of Jewish people. So that would be the millennial view. But the fact is that I cannot say with certainty that is a good understanding of what happens during the Seder. And the only reason I say that is because we don't know its history. Even the rabbis don't know.
Right.
We don't know the meaning of it. And so it's just something that's done. And I could say, boy, there's a lot of symbolism there. It looks like it teaches up. But to say it teaches this, absolutely, I think that would be wrong.
Well, it's kind of like in Luke 16, when the rich man tells Abraham, you know, send somebody who come back from the dead to speak to my brothers. And he said, well, you know, they have Moses and the prophets, let them believe them. And so, we have enough.
Yeah.
Even if we didn't have that per se to utilize.
That's a wonderful parable, by the way.
There's no excuse. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. I preached on that, called the Dialogue in Eternity.
So parable or real event?
I went with the parable.
Amen.
I went with the parable.
I studied that for many, many years, going back and forth, reading everything I could on that. And I convinced myself from this study that it's a parable. I was hard set against that when I started.
I was
going to prove someone that it was not a parable, and I was wrong.
Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, the first thing we hear, we go with until another comes and examines it, like it says in Proverbs. And so
I think that's Solomon wrote something like that.
Yeah, Proverbs. So based on your experience, do you find that there's pride in the meritorious works and sincere devotion that, you know, that people say, well, you know, I'm pleasing God, whether it's in Islam and Judaism, Roman Catholicism. And does that play a part in the way we share the gospel with them?
Pride affects everything with human beings, especially the unsaved. The unsaved are clearly going to be where, you know, Jewish person, Catholic person, very similar, very steeped in tradition. And to go against the tradition is, you know, would in my case, I mean, to become a Christian and go against Judaism and deny Judaism. My parents probably would have had no problem with me denying Judaism, but to convert to Christianity, I knew they'd bury an empty casket. I'd be dead to them.
Right.
And they did go casket shopping when they found out. They chose not to do that. But they did do the shopping for one. They were planning on it. And there's a risk in that. Now in Islam, to convert from Islam to something else in a Muslim country, that is a death sentence.
Is that shirk?
Yeah, it is a crime to convert from Islam to anything else.
And then they call that Christophobia there?
Christophobia? No.
They don't call it Christophobia. No. Okay. So it's just if we disagree, not hatred, but disagree.
Yeah.
then well, it's Islamophobia. Right?
See, the thing is that if you go from Islam to Judaism, they're not going to call it Christophobia, right? So it's, but there is this belief, and by the way, just so people realize, since we're talking Islam, there is a belief in Islam called taqiyya. Taqiyya is the ability to lie to defend the faith. So you could say something you know is a falsehood, as long as you're saying that you're doing it to defend the faith. And I had a debate with a imam at a university, and when I brought up the issue that we talked about with God being Allah being a deceiver in the crucifixion of Jesus, I remember him saying, "Well, it didn't work that way. You're not right." And I looked at him. I said, "Are you practicing taqiyya right now?" And he literally stopped and looked at me and turned to the audience and says, "He understands Islam." Mm. And that's all he said, you know, because he knew exactly what he was doing. He was lying to defend the faith. And so what we have is we have a case where every man-made religious system is based on human effort. So yes, their pride is going to play into that. But Christian, don't be too hard on other people's pride and not your own. Look, we have problems with pride in Christianity. You have every group within Christianity. If you want to look at the charismatics, they get saved and then they get a second blessing. And there are those people who are prideful about that. Like, you don't count if you don't have that second blessing that they would call the baptism of the Holy Spirit. I would have a different definition of the baptism of the Holy Spirit. But then you have the Calvinists. They're called stage cage Calvinists that are like, "Oh, well, hey, I got saved, but then I got reformed and now I got the 5 points." And it's like, everyone must believe this. And they look down on anyone that doesn't believe that. And you have the fundamentalists. They get saved and then they get King James only, right? I mean, every group has this element of pride, because until the moment we die, we are still struggling with our pride. So the reality is, if you don't recognize pride in your own life, that is definitely going to affect the way that you share the gospel, let alone their pride, because you have to first recognize your own pride. And I'll tell you, son, Phil, you have seen how I teach our ambassador evangelism style. But one of the things I tell is I learned to disarm my own defenses by learning to ask good questions. Why? Because I discovered I have a problem with pride. And the story I always tell with it is, I had a guy, I was in Freehold, New Jersey. I was standing on a ledge preaching the gospel. A guy walks up to me, says, "You know, Christianity's stupid." I said, "Really? Can you support that claim?" And he said, "Yeah. How many chromosomes are there in a human being? You happen to know that, Phil, in the school system, but not
46.
Huh?
46.
Okay, so divide 46 by 2.
23.
So actually, the way he said it is, how many from the mother?
23.
How many from the father?
The same.
He says, "Well, see, that's how stupid Christians are. You can't divide 23 by two. and I looked at him and said, "You're an idiot. You don't divide 23 by two. You divide 46 by two. And he walked away and with a smile on his face. And what it was he got me to act in a way where I acted pridefully, and he felt justified in saying, "Oh, see, that guy's an idiot," and he could walk away. And so I recognized I was wrong. And I did exactly, Phil, what you would do in that situation. I repented. I asked God for a second chance. And in comes the guy from my left, walks past me, goes, "You still stupid?" And I went, without hesitation, "Are you still an idiot?" Oh, I am so hard-headed. He walked off and I just was like, I remember I'm sitting there still trying to preach the gospel, and I'm praying in my mind, "Lord, I am so hard-hearted, like so hard to, like, prideful. Could you bring the guy one more time?" And sure enough, he did. The guy comes back from my right side. And I got off the ledge, walked over to him, and I said, "Sir, the way I spoke to you is wrong. I need to ask your forgiveness." He goes, "Well, you're still stupid." I stopped myself from saying, "Well, you're still an idiot." No. We could be prideful. And so, yeah, our own pride can affect the way we share the gospel. But you have to realize that for some of the people that you're going to share the gospel with, especially with like a Jehovah Witness, where they are absolutely works-based. They're spending their entire life works-based. To say that what they believe is wrong is to reject everything they've poured like almost every waking minute of their day in.
Sure.
And so it basically is to say everything I've done is a waste.
Right. And
for some, a lot of people, that's really hard to do. So yeah, it does play into it when we share the gospel. And therefore, what I recommend is know that they're prideful with that. Try to soften it. You don't attack hard on that. As Ray Comfort would say, you know, you give law to the proud and grace to the humble. We use the law to break them of that pride, but you give grace once they're broken. So I don't know if you know Chad Williams, who used to work at Living Waters with Ray Comfort, but Chad and I were out once. He and I were just out on Huntington Beach together evangelizing. He's up on a box. He's preaching, and this guy is just being so hard-hearted to Chad. And Chad did something I've never seen him do before. He just looks at this guy and goes, "No gospel for you." And the guy stood up and looked. He says, "I was going to give you the gospel today, but no gospel for you." And the guy walked off. And it was such a bizarre thing for Chad to do. He got down and we're packing up. And I'm like, "Chad, dude, what was with that? Like, why did," he goes, "I don't know." He goes, "I don't know what came over me. It's just like, I felt like I was throwing pearls before swine. I mean, I'm giving him this glorious message of the gospel or wanting to. And he's just so prideful." And literally as Chad is saying that, the same guy walks up to us and he's now totally different demeanor. He goes up to Chad and says, "Why can't I have the gospel?" And Chad goes, "Now you can." And he shared the gospel with him. That is a great example of what Ray says about law to the proud, grace to the humble.
Yeah, I think it was Spurgeon who also said, "If they don't see tears in your eyes, let them hear tears in your voice." We need to exhibit a concern, especially when you start to learn good theology, apologetics, and if you're in cage stage, bring all that together, and you could just try to win arguments rather than win the person. So sometimes I've said, "Listen, let me put my cards out of the table. I'm not trying to win this argument, I'm trying to win you." Because, I mean, what does it matter if you win the argument at the end of the day? You just, you know, you beat them into intellectual submission. Because, I mean, we have the arguments on our side. And sometimes
we have the truth on our side.
Right.
They may make good arguments, but we have the truth on our side.
Right. We have the truth, you know, but they need a converted heart. They need a changed heart. And yes, you know, we defend and we contend for the faith, and we put down every argument that rises and tries to exalt itself, above the truth of God. But it's not to just beat them into intellectual submission. It's that they would come to know Christ, not so that you can give the high five to your friend and say, look at the way I handled an atheist. Come on, high five, you know, another one. I mean, people see that. People see that. I believe you and I spoke about that years ago as well. And, you know, if we're doing that when we're trying to share the gospel with people, then, you know, we need to ask God to forgive us and change our own hearts, because we want their heart to change and come to Christ. Well, our heart has to change to become more like Christ. So last question, what are some good resources for witnessing to those involved in Islam and Judaism that you know? And give me another plug for your book there.
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, I'll plug my book. Yeah. obviously, What Do They Believe is a book. What I've tried to do different, there's a lot of books out there that you could read that talk about the different religions. I dealt with the major Western religions, and what I tried to do is systematize them from their authorities. So I look at what they hold to as an authority, and I'm looking at what's their authority, what's their view of God, specifically Trinity, what's their view of Christ, specifically his deity, man's sinfulness, salvation, end times. I'm looking at those things. And then what I'm looking to do within that is to get an understanding of Judaism, Catholicism, Islam, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness, and Christianity. I want to do a fair representation. That's why what I do is I actually went to people of those religions and said, "Here, am I accurate to what you believe?" Because what I'm trying to do in that book is not show you the problems with their views as much as say, this is what they do believe. So that when you are in a discussion with them, you can have that discussion and they're not saying, hey, you're misrepresenting me. I mean, when a person comes to me and says, you believe in three gods, well, we're done now, right? Right. Because you don't have a good understanding of what the Trinity is. So What Do They Believe would be a book that I would recommend. The As far as Islam, James White has a really good book. I'm forgetting the title of it.
What Every Christian Should Know About the Quran Islam. Or Islam?
It's Islam or the Quran. Yeah, one of those. That'd be good. Dr. Michael Brown has a lot of books on Judaism. He's got a five-volume set on witnessing to Jewish people or to answering some of the objections. And so I'd recommend that. I wouldn't recommend Michael Brown on many things. When it comes to the charismatic movement, I think he's kind of too far. But when it comes to his views, his arguments against Judaism, his arguments against homosexuality, very solid. So you can get books like Kingdom of the Cults, which will give you good overviews of many religions. I think that if you're going to study Islam, you want to study from someone that actually is looking to get Islam right. And James White does a good job of trying to be fair with their views. So Nabil Koresh is another one that has some books out, several books that talk about that.
Yeah, he has Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus.
Well, that's more his testimony.
Right, right.
That's helpful.
Yeah. Someone sent me something as a rebuttal to his testimony. So I'm in the process of still listening to that.
Maybe another resource that's not necessarily a book would be to go to carm.org, carm.org.
Yes.
Matt Slick, I mentioned him earlier, he has a lot of material out there on different, not just Judaism and Islam. I don't know how much he has on Judaism. He has stuff on Islam, a lot of stuff on Islam, but he has stuff on other religions as well. That'll be helpful. But the key with anything is this. I would say when it comes to evangelism, don't rely on a book, not even mine. Right. Talk to the person that you're talking with and spend the time to ask them questions. Understand what they believe, because it's not a guarantee that what they believe is what the doctrine of their organization would believe. Well, you can have someone that says they're Catholic and they don't believe what the Catholic Church teaches.
Yeah, no, that's true. You have to ask each individual. Another good series is Reasoning from the Scriptures With. That's by Ron Rhodes, and it's Reasoning from the Scriptures with Muslims, Reasoning from the Scriptures with Jehovah's Witnesses, Roman Catholics, and the like. So he has a good series. I don't agree with his Arminian position, but he gives you questions to ask that are good questions, such as the things, you know, that Andrew's bringing up. So I really appreciate his writing in that way. He seems to really understand what they believe. And then you're asking questions to those groups concerning what they believe. Like, how do you explain that the Quran speaks about the Trinity as a Father, Son, and Mary when Christians don't hold that? You know, what do you say? And so you're able to ask them questions. And this is how you have good dialogue. But not only does he have questions, but I think he has the right questions. There's a difference between just asking questions and asking the right questions to really dig down into the dialogue and get down to the nitty gritty, as Nacho Libre would say. And there's tons of other good resources out there. I think The Gospel for Muslims by Thabiti Anabwile, although I don't really recommend his current stuff because he has seemed to have gone woke. But that book, I believe, is a solid one. And if you need any others, just email us and we could see if we could hunt down some additional ones. And be kind, you know, be kind to your Muslim neighbors and Jewish neighbors and those of various world religions. We don't need to be in cage stage, if you will, and be unkind, because even the doctrines of grace are called the doctrines of grace. They're not the doctrines of pride and arrogance. And so knowing as such, we should not, as one of my friends, Anthony Avenio, the reform rookie, said, we should not let others outgrace us. So, amen. Andrew, any final words for us, brother?
No, thanks for the honor of being on your podcast. I always like spending time with you. So for folks, just remember to stop and think about it.
If you would like to contact us, please email us at stopandthinkcrew@gmail.com. You could also visit our website at www.stopandthinkpodcast.com. This podcast is listener-supported by generous people like you. You can give a tax-deductible donation at our affiliate ministry at www.soulfishingministries.org and click on our donate link to give securely through PayPal. Thank you for listening to Stop and Think About It.